Alright, time for another DraftPhysics.com video presentation. Debate physics also. Can't really find a debater, though. Anyway, so part two of the story of the Châtelet, more than the story of actual thermodynamics and actual history of the concept of energy. The concept of energy has an older history, frankly, this is where the story goes wrong. This is where it starts meandering and traveling weird and crooked paths. But anyway, let's continue. I think we're somewhere around here. So we've just seen the lead ball, famous clay experiment, which obviously you have to think clay is a really great measuring tool, that it doesn't have a bias, that fast things don't go through it easier than slow things. If you believe that, then okay, you proved it. If you don't believe that clay is perfect, then, you know, that you can mix it thick, you can mix it thin, you get different results, that it's not a good yardstick, then, yeah, okay, this isn't really a proof.
Well, the ball travels 4 times further.
Now, the point is, too, is when they made this TV show, did they actually do the experiment, or did they just push the thing in dramatically deeper? You know, or does this actually even happen? There's a good question whether this experiment can even be repeated.
Anyway, in 1740...
It's not an anyway kind of thing, but anyway, let's play with the word anyway. So in 1740, yes, this is still, I thought she died in like 1741. She didn't die till 1748. So you have to know the sequence. This is really close, just a year or two away from when when she and Voltaire entered the fire thing. So, and I found a quote from Voltaire where he's writing to somebody posthumously after she's dead, and talking about the fact that she actually had quit being a devotee of Leibniz, which is interesting, right? I mean, you know, somewhere between this 1740 and 1748, she drifted away from the philosophy.
Emily du Châtelet published a book called Lessons in Physics.
Now, I finally found this. So that was really, you know, I said, I got to find this damn book. It's got to be, you know, all you can find is French copies, this, that, all this other crap. I finally found an English translation. Most of it, anyway. Pieces are missing, but... and it's a steaming pile of crap. I mean, the first 3 chapters are all wooey metaphysics, proof of God kind of crap, you know. Just horrible, frankly. And it's supposed to be a book she wrote to educate her son, I guess duplicating the lessons. But the book really is just littered with this controversy of mv squared versus momentum, and tons of references to Leibniz, and it even goes through some of the arguments that were made, by other scientists. And it just demonstrates how terribly thin, terribly unevidenced the whole thing is. And it's just kind of funny because it's not really a kid's book. I mean, she's really taking hard shots at other people's theories. She insults Descartes gratuitously, overtly saying he's wrong and he's this and he's, and he has the wrong attitude and he's wrong this and wrong. So it's really not a kid's book in any way. I mean, your kid's not going to get too educated by dissecting an argument with such a huge bias in her dissection. So, whatever. I'm just saying it's not what they propaganda to be. It's not, a kid's book.
Which was the first to champion Newton's theories and the idea of a living force.
So again, it didn't really do it in any honest way beyond championing it in the sense that she thought Newton's prestige was too high. And, obviously she thought he was wrong. And it's a real controversy. So that's the other part to point out, is that they've turned it into semantics. You know, the historians are saying this is just semantics, an argument over semantics. clearly she knew it wasn't semantics, and I think Newton knew it wasn't semantics, and all the people in the argument knew it wasn't just semantics. That this is a fundamental core belief thing, okay? You can't do this all kinds of ways. It has to be made out of real cement. It can't be some mushy quicksand.
And help promote both Newton's and Leibniz's theories.
Obviously, when she's talking about geometry and the ellipses and different things, then it's Newton, okay? And then when she's talking about something else that's more metaphysical, all of a sudden it's Leibniz. So she doesn't do any, there aren't too many instances where she does a direct comparison. So the one instance I did find, I can't for the life of me understand what the hell she's talking about. So it just has to do with what Newton said in, not in his Principia, but in his Optics book about the motion of objects and his conclusion, which is kind of funny, you know, his conclusion that the universe would die a heat death. So, I mean, Newton had already argued that heat death was inevitable. But I don't really know how she turned that into Newton arguing, I mean, how she countered it with mv squared somehow comes to the rescue and saves the universe from heat death. I don't, you know, it doesn't make much sense. I have to read it a few hundred more times because I just can't, it's just impossible to follow what the hell they're talking about.
France, Germany, and even England. Du Châtelet continued to research science.
So I don't know what happened to the English translation, but apparently it doesn't exist anywhere because other people, I mean, you know, I think it was Notre Dame or something, someplace anyway, that did the translation.
1747, she completed her magnum opus, the first and still gold standard.
Right, so that's the 7 years later, okay, and this was the thing she had worked on for years where she's just doing a translation of Newton and just putting footnotes, apparently, to Leibniz. So I don't know how heavy they are. So that would be a real test of what Voltaire said, is how heavy the Leibniz references are, because the point is she basically was not as big a fan of Leibnizian theory as she was originally.
French translation of Newton's Principia with footnotes about the living force. Tragically.
So I'd like to see the footnotes, I guess. You know, because the attitude of those footnotes would obviously indicate whether she was putting them there as a, yes, you must be aware that there is this counter argument, or whether they're there as a assertion that Newton was wrong and these, you know, Leibnizian theories are so much more well proven, because she really thought they were well proven by evidence in 1740. She was asserting it as a fact very aggressively in 1740. And the question would be, was she still asserting it as a fact very aggressively in 1948?
She died just before its publication at age 42 from complications from childbirth.
Well, who knows what she died of. Apparently it was just an infection of some kind, but the kid died of it also just a couple of days later. So there's an open question there. She apparently didn't deliver the baby in any kind of clinically appropriate circumstance. Apparently she had the baby at her writing desk. And after she had the baby, they took her to her bedroom. So she didn't even have the baby in, like, you know, a place you're supposed to have a baby. I mean, a place that might be clean enough. So they might have both died of some sort of infection, you know. Just, it's horrible. Yeah, I mean, just a really horrible story. You know, and the irony is she thought it was a perfect world, and that, you know, the fact is that somehow, you know, in God's infinite knowledge, this is the perfect way to make the universe happen, is, you know, if we kill her and her baby, then we can make all these other great and good things happen. But if we don't kill her and her baby, all the great good things won't happen. That's the Leibnizian Du Châtelet philosophy. And you've got to just say to yourself, oh, come on, too stupid.
After her death, Emily Du Châtelet's ideas about Newton, Leibniz, fire, light.
Yes, and they're not very good ideas, frankly. It's all a big pile of mush. Read it. It's mush.
Philosophy and living forces were all reproduced, sometimes plagiarized word for word, by her friend Diderot in the very influential French Encyclopedia.
So this is how propaganda takes place, right? Somebody says something, he's a boogerhead. And then somebody else says, yeah, it's proven he's a boogerhead. Yeah.
Influence was obscured by her death, but her scientific ideas flourished. Fast forward to England.
Yeah, so why is the question? Why did it flourish when it makes no sense, when a lever proves it's wrong? But I guess nobody just did that simple argument. I mean, they talk about levers, but they don't make the simple argument. Well, some people do, and they just ignore it, right? So people made the simple argument that a lever is a free energy device by your theory. And, they just ignore that argument and start talking about some other abstraction where they can convolute the facts to turn it into, some necessity to, it's like when they were talking about gravity, they turned gravity into springs. And then they say, well, if you go this distance, you have to compress the spring that amount. So again, just not even acknowledging that the higher velocity means you don't have to compress those springs. It's just one unit of time. Time is the spring. Distance isn't the spring. Time is the spring. That simple change. I mean, it's just it's really just amazing that the whole thing just hinges on this simple understanding of gravity, whether it's about how long you're in the gravity or how much distance you travel in gravity. And, all rational people ought to just concede the argument that we already know that per mile it takes less fuel to go the farther distance. The further you go, the further you shoot for, the less fuel you'll need per unit of distance to go that distance. There's a huge efficiency per mile. Per mile use of gas goes way down as you go further. And how can anyone argue with that? I mean, that's such an established fact that you don't pay the same for every foot you travel in gravity. I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm just back to, I already did these arguments, but you can just see it in the fact that the faster you travel next to a planet, the less the gravity bends you, because it has less time to bend you. You're in it less.
In 1807. That was when a doctor and scientist named Thomas Young.
So she doesn't point out of two slit fame, of wave particle duality, of, doing an experiment that was really poorly described and illustrated. In the sense that the actual pattern created by light, the double slit, has really no connection whatsoever to water waves. Water waves can't describe the complex, more complex pattern created by light, photons. That it's not in any real way can it be considered similar besides in the most superficial ways.
Was famous for his double slit experiment from a few...
Oh, okay, she does say it. Yeah, it was also famous for, it did a tremendous amount of work with color blindness and all kinds of other stuff that was really great. So, definitely a good scientist, but obviously some of the stuff, good people can do crap, and some of it was crap. Good musicians or whatever sometimes put out a clunker album. Just, it's the way it works.
Years earlier, that demonstrated that light acts like a wave, was asked to...
So it really doesn't. He didn't demonstrate it, and he illustrated it with completely inaccurate diagrams that aren't mathematically correct. So it really was just garbage science.
To give a series of lectures on the current state of science, Young decided to make his lectures as simple as possible, because he wanted to dedicate it to the women in the audience, specifically because he felt the upper class...
So I don't know if you need all of this, but the fact that he used the word energy because he heard it somewhere else. So let's understand. And so he got popularized because Young used it, and these were lectures that were published eventually as a book. And so the word energy became more... people were more accustomed to it, just like there was a point where there wasn't a word called photon, and then there was the word photon.
Women would be better served if they spent their time in the, quote, acquisition of knowledge instead of wasting their time, the insipid consumption of superfluous time.
Yes, gambling and all other kinds of things. So that's another issue with the Chatelet. She did live a very fancy pants life, and she spent a lot of time gambling, you know, doing things that are pretty lowbrow, blah, blah, blah.
Anyway, in his fifth lecture out of 60, he decided to rename the living force, or the mass times speed squared, saying that, quote, the living force is somewhat more concisely expressed by the term energy. His lectures were published.
So again, it's, you know, the living force needed to be changed because it didn't sound very scientific. And, you know, so that was one incentive. And yes, they had to contrive the new version of it that actually got closer to right answers. It's still way off, but it's not twice as way off. So they stuck the half in front of it because it was overtly getting numbers that were obviously silly.
As a book.
But by putting the half in front of it, they did ruin any connection it has to all those gravity arguments. All the gravity arguments are thrown away once they put the one half in front of it. So all the proofs from gravity are, you know, you can't make the spring argument anymore. You can't make any of those arguments because now you have a half in front of the equation.
And soon his simplified physics for the ladies caught on in England, and the term energy was used instead of living force, at least in England. Now we go back to France, and two ex-soldiers, Sadi Carnot.
So now we're going back in time, I think. We'll find out.
Carnot and Gaspard Gustave Coriolis, who are interested in the efficiency of machines. As Carnot put it, quote, the study of engines is of the greatest interest as their importance is enormous, and they seem destined to produce a great revolution in the civilized world.
So I would argue that this is another one of these things where you just see where the path went wrong, because this is where they're going to develop a work equation that really doesn't have anything to do with the truth. Yeah.
Both men were the children of generals, and both men in the early 1800s went to the same school to study engineering for military officers. However, Sadi Carnot started in a much better position in French society, as he was the son of one of Napoleon's top captains, and Coriolis was the son of the former king's top captains, and King Louis had been decapitated when Coriolis was just an infant. They switched social positions in 1815 when Napoleon was defeated and Carnot's father was exiled. Sadi Carnot was...
So, I don't know why she needed to put in all that stuff, frankly. I mean, there's all these tragedies, right? I think the one guy, okay, so he was privileged, then he was exiled, so then he ended up working on some island, and then he got cholera and died. Yeah, it's all, you know, they're all horrible stories. Yeah, it's really so few good stories.
Allowed to remain in France, but he found military life very frustrating without any political power. And in 1818, Carnot left the military and holed up in his brother's apartment in Paris, secretively studying science. Carnot wouldn't even tell his brother what he was working on. Meanwhile, Coriolis' father died, and Coriolis left the military so that he can make a little bit more money as a scientist studying engineering systems.
See, I just, you know, all this background is, you know, kind of fluff. I don't know if it really, you know...
As a former engineer, he had a lot more technical experience with actual engines than the typical academic. In 1829, Coriolis published a book on the physics of machines. In this book, Coriolis defined a new term that he called work, that he defined as the force times the distance in the direction of motion.
So the force times the distance, you know, so again, that works, you know, from machines. Doesn't work in gravity.
Surprisingly, this is still the modern physics definition of work. Moreover,
yeah, because it really comes down to when you're measuring the distance in time, you're measuring velocity. So it's really just mass times velocity again. You're just finding another way of saying mass times velocity. You're just saying momentum. But whatever, continuing.
However, with this new definition of work, Coriolis used calculus and found that if an object was pushed on a flat surface, the object would have a change in 1/2 the mass times speed squared.
Because, you know, the one half the mass times speed squared. So she said speed squared, which is interesting. You know, all right, but yeah, I don't know exactly why the one half would be in there, except for the fact that the work portion is only half of the energy. Half the energy has to go to the thing you're using to do your work against. You have to hold the water wheel for the water wheel to collect the energy. Half the energy is in the thing holding the water wheel while the water wheel spins. So the total energy of the system, okay, is both pieces. And you're really just saying the work portion is the portion I'm taking advantage of. It's really only half the force in total. But you can never see the total force because it's just the example of the explosion. It goes this way and it goes that way. Technically, okay. I mean, technically you can collect all of it as pressure, but the point would be is that you're either on this side of it or that side of it.
Coriolis therefore decided to make what he called a slight modification to the definition of living force and define it as one half mv squared instead of mv squared.
Right, so this is where the one half is thrown in now. It's a rather dramatic change. So just understand, you're going from saying something has 400 joules to it having 200 joules. I mean, big change, gigantic change. And this disconnects the theory from all the gravitational arguments, because now you can't argue that, well, the object go twice as fast as to go four times higher in velocity into gravity. Well, now you're losing that four-time relationship, and you're really just saying it's twice. Yeah. Well, it's half of a square, so obviously it fluctuates, but you lose any capacity to argue explicitly for four times the distance equals, you know, four times the velocity. It doesn't, and it certainly doesn't add four times the work. That's why the half is there, is to kill that exaggeration.
To add, quote, simplicity to the principles. He then found that if you had a machine that pushed an object up a hill, then the work minus the weight times the height equaled the change in living force. In other words, the work equals the change in kinetic energy plus the change in potential energy due to gravity.
Right, but, you know, frankly, it still doesn't, it's changing what the potential of gravity is by defining it again by distance, height, but you've halved it. So you're really, again, you've stepped away from mv squared and are now moderating something where you're trying to take, like I said, in certain circumstances, kinetic energy formula works because the square ends up being exactly twice what you're having. So the half will reduce it back to momentum. So momentum and kinetic energy agree twice a day. You know, the broken clock and the working clock agree twice a day.
If this sounds like what you learned in high school, you're right. The only thing missing is heat. Now we go back to Carnot hiding out in his brother's apartment. In 1824, Carnot decided to publish his theories about heat engines and heat. In this pamphlet, Carnot assumed that heat comes from hot objects and goes to cold objects, and the bigger temperature difference, the more efficient the engine. All things we think true today. Carnot also came up with an idealized engine that is most efficient, that is currently called the Carnot engine. But then he...
Yeah, but see, the trick is you can't really create insulators. So it's like the idea of you're trying to create a laser beam. You're trying to force all the energy to go in the direction of your pressure. And so like in a car cylinder, you're trying to say, okay, I want all the energy to go into the motion of the cylinder, and I want any of the energy to be heating the cylinder. Well, then you have to put some sort of insulator to prevent the heat from moving through the metal. And any insulator you create has to be thin, and it has to be durable. And thin and durable insulation doesn't work. It's not going to work. It's just going to melt off the surface. So, I mean, they try things like Teflon and different things, but yeah, it gets too hot and it doesn't work. So there's no way to create this barrier that'll prevent the heat from escaping, and force the heat energy to continue to push the cylinder, the pressure. So it allows the pressure to escape in the form of heat.
made a mistake. He wrote that, quote, the production of power is not due to an actual consumption of heat, but to its transportation from a warm body to a cold body.
Now, she says that's a mistake, but frankly, I think that's right on. You always have to tap a river. You're always just sticking your wheel in a stream. And you have to do it based on the principle that I can't do it in space, you know, because then everything moves. You know, I have to have secure it to something, the water wheel, for the wheel to spin. So, I mean, there's rules. And the fact is that you're only collecting the energy that's moving. You can only take energy where there's laser beams or rivers or something where the energy is just moving in one direction. And you have a capacity to nail yourself to moving in the opposite direction or not moving at all. You have some way to secure yourself from being just swept by the stream.
In other words, Carnot thought that an engine absorbed as much heat as it emitted. It was
okay, absorbed as much as the heat is just waste. So whatever heat you're creating is waste, because all you care about is motion, and the motion is a conversion of the heat. So half the heat, you could argue, in an engine is waste, and the other half is converted into motion. So that's the inefficiency, you know, that you're trying to fight with. You're trying to escape. It should be back, continuing and such.
Only the movement of heat that caused the engine to do work. The idea that heat is a fluid that you cannot destroy or create was called the caloric theory and was very popular in France at the time. Over the years,
I don't think it was all that bad a theory, frankly, but whatever.
Carnot started to rethink his idea that heat is an indestructible fluid.
All right, well, it's certainly indestructible, and it does migrate forever in the universe, so everything is heat. It's just a clump of it, or not a clump of it, frankly. When it's pushing matter, it goes slower and slower the more matter the heat is pushing. And that's the simple truth of it. But the heat is the elemental, you could argue, pressure in the universe. It's what makes the matter move.
He wrote in his notebook, heat is simply a movement among the particles of bodies. Wherever there's a destruction of motive power, there is at the same time production of heat in quantity exactly proportional to the quantity of motive power destroyed.
So again, there's nothing destroyed, so it's just the fact that you're giving something, and to push one way, you sort of have to, you know, push the other. So it's, you have to give something away. You can't release. If I have a vessel and it has two things in it, one thing going this way and one thing going that way, if I let this thing out, I have to go that way because I've changed my balance. So if I give something away, I'm obligated to be stuck with the fact that I have less of whatever I gave away and more of the opposite of it. If I had a balance before then, I had a condition before then. And if I subtract a number, if I have four and I take and I throw one over, then I have three. So I moved. I have to move where, like I said, if I give something away, there are consequences. I gave it away. I don't have it anymore. And therefore, my condition changes. I get poorer if I give away my money, and other people get richer.
Reciprocally, whenever there is a destruction of heat, there is a production of motive power.
If you're a homeowner in New Jersey and you're still paying for electricity, then you could be missing out on free government assistance to go solar.
Tragically, before he could publish...
Do it the stupid way.
These thoughts. Sadi Carnot died of cholera at age 36. And these thoughts were only published in 1890, years after.
Yeah, that's really another sad story.
After others gained fame for its discovery. Very few people read Carnot's book while he was alive. But
so, again, why are you mentioning it almost, you know, unfortunately? Yeah, because he got surpassed by, you know, other people who drew the conclusion.
But 2 years after his death, another Frenchman and engineer named Paul Clapeyron based his book on heat engines on Carnot's book, which slowly gained popularity. Whew, that's a lot of people and ideas. Let's do a little recap.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's all that useful, frankly, but go ahead.
In 1747, Emily...
Oh, well, don't go back that far. You should have gone back to Leibniz, the creator of this coup.
Du Châtelet combined the ideas of conserving living force, mv squared, with Newton's ideas.
Well, obviously, Newton's laws are violated by mv squared. So again, if the bullet has 2,000 joules and the gun only has 2, then you have to argue that, well, that whole third law of Newton's can't mean much. I mean, the equal and opposite reaction can't mean much if there's 2,000 of something going one way and only 2 of something going the other way.
And her theories were plagiarized, memorialized in the French Encyclopedia of 1751. In 1807, Thomas Young...
Well, the argument was that her little book teaching kids was actually plagiarized from the teachers she had. So the guy actually made the claim, the guy who tutored her made the claim that her book was just full of all the stuff he had told her. So, you know, the accusations never end. It's the nature of the human monster.
Calls the living force energy to make it easier for the ladies. In 1824...
So he didn't invent the word, but whatever.
Carnot publishes book on heat and is ignored for 10 years. In 1829, Coriolis defined work as force times distance and redefined the living force.
So 1829, that's pretty late in the game, right? So it took him till 1829 to realize, hey, this theory is completely irrational. Let's put a half in front of it and try to make it less irrational.
I.e. the kinetic energy as 1/2 mv squared. In 1834, Clapeyron publishes...
And this is in the environment where, again, I don't think there was a single experiment that really proved momentum would get you a wrong answer. So, you know...
His thoughts on Carnot's work, including the idea that heat flows from hot to cold, and the erroneous idea that heat is indestructible.
Now, so I don't even know why they're saying that's erroneous, when... How do you destroy heat? I don't know. I mean, why is she arguing it's erroneous to argue that heat is indestructible? How do you destroy it? I mean, could you give me an example of it destroyed somewhere? Because I don't know how you destroy it. I can't imagine how you destroy it. How you just make it go away and not exist in the universe anymore? So, somebody want to give me an example of that one?
Now we move back to England and a young brewer named James Joule. In 18...
Yeah, I thought he was American, but, you know, it doesn't really matter.
40, 22-year-old Joule decided to systematically study if an electric motor would be more efficient than a steam engine in his bottling factory.
Now, the truth is he was really interested in science, so he inherited the brewery, so that was his business, but he really was keenly interested in these scientific questions for their own value. So, you know, you have to be fair to the context. He really did do a lot of personal research on the subjects and was really quite a good scientist, frankly.
Joule then found the equation for the amount of heat that a resistor will produce as a function of the current through it, an equation we still use today. Joule also studied how much chemical energy came from the battery and was surprised to find them equivalent. He then became obsessed with the science of heat and started building elaborate and astonishingly precise devices.
Precise, I wouldn't say they're elaborate, but very precise, okay? They're pretty simple devices. They're just very precisely made.
Where falling weights would drive...
See, this was sort of the big liability was the idea of using falling weights, because this is an example of you getting half the energy, in a sense, because the only time you're gaining energy is while it's falling, and you're basically resisting, you're stopping it from falling. So it's falling in stages, and you're taking advantage of the stages of its progression of its fall. But you're... broken the time equation.
The spinning paddle, which would then increase the temperature of the water to demonstrate the relationship between work and heat. By 1843,
Joule... So, really good idea, and I think they're misinterpreting it as being that there's heat is the waste and you're measuring the waste, when what the real mechanism is it's completely converting all of the energy of the system into heat. So it's converting it. But obviously the weight does fall. So you can't take all the energy because the weight wouldn't fall if you could get all the energy, kind of argument.
I was trying to convince anyone and everyone that, quote, wherever mechanical force is expended, an exact equivalent of heat is always obtained.
So I would argue that isn't true, that you can have a system where you create very little waste, heat, very little friction, and so then you can maintain the system. We just can't do that here, right? We can't create a perpetual motion machine on Earth, but we could create one in space. Just a fact.
But Jule was not a professor. He was just a lowly brewer, and most people didn't listen to him.
I mean, a perpetual motion to our tolerances, you know, something that would spin for 50 years. You know, you give it one spin, it goes for 50 years because you got a good bearing and there's no gravitational theft.
He kept on talking, though. In 1847, he gave a talk at Oxford, where he greatly impressed the audience, including a 23-year-old Scottish math and physics phenomenon named William Thomson.
I mean, the gravitational theft is the fact that we can't make a bearing, okay, that is frictionless, because gravity keeps pushing on one part of the bearing all the time, so it doesn't work. But if you go with no gravity, then your bearing can be perfect almost, in the sense that there's no contact. It spins, it comes to a perfectly smooth oscillation in a perfect orbit and just spins as if something's orbiting around a satellite. And it becomes a frictionless orbit.
Thomson was impressed with Joule's experiments, but he didn't initially agree with his conclusions. See, Thomson had read Clapeyron's book about Carnot and was a huge fan of Carnot and Carnot's theories. He therefore thought that in order to like Carnot, you had to believe in the indestructibility of heat.
Well, again, I would still argue, you can't, how do you destroy heat? I just don't even know that this was an issue, frankly. I didn't even know there could possibly be a concept where somehow you can make heat go away. You can only make it go away in the sense it goes over there. Can't get rid of it. Just can't. There's no way to get rid of it. There's no place to put it where it goes away.
Thomson decided that Carnot's theories were a good theoretical basis for creating an absolute temperature scale and became the first person to correctly get that absolute zero is 273 degrees Celsius below freezing. By the way, Thomson was knighted 44 years later and became known as Lord Kelvin, which is why the absolute temperature scale is measured in Kelvins in his honor. Anyway, this paper of eight.
It's hard to imagine how this relates to de Chatelet's mv squared, but whatever.
1848, Thomson mirrored what he thought were Carnot's theory about the caloric, saying, quote, the source of power is not in any absorption and conversion of heat, but merely in a transmission of heat. Although Thomson did add in a footnote that, quote, Mr. Joule of Manchester made some very remarkable discoveries, which led to a contrary opinion in heat. This paper.
So, again, they're really not that contrary. You know, one is saying I'm going to convert the work, you know, the part we can collect, into heat. And the other is arguing that, well, there is heat also created in the environment that you can't collect. It's waste heat. So you can convert the actual work into an equivalent of heat. And you can also have inefficiency in your system where there's heat in your pulleys and there's heat over here and heat over there where you lost part of your energy to heat. There's the waste heat and then there's the work. They're both heat. You're really just saying, again, a laser beam is just heat. You're just directing it in one little beam. The, you know, the light bulb is directing it everywhere. So yeah, it doesn't seem like it's the same thing, but it's the same thing.
Made Carnot's theories instantly and internationally famous. In addition, Joule was delighted to have a real scientist mention him, even in a footnote, and they started a correspondence.
So it's not really all that true. I mean, Joule was already a respected character, and, you know, he was invited to speak and to show and to do all these things, you know. But yes, a little publicity doesn't hurt.
Which led to a fruitful collaboration.
Wim Ping. Wham, wham.
Eventually, Joule became a famous professor, and the units of energy are called joules in his honor. Meanwhile, back in January of 1849, Thomson wrote another paper, this one only about Carnot's theories. It was this paper that led to the last scientist on our list, a quiet German named Rudolf Clausius. Clausius was born in 1822 and was the youngest of 18 children. Yep.
Oh, geez. Crazy is as crazy does.
I said that right, 18. When Clausius was 21, his family ran out of money, probably all those kids, and he had to drop out of school and become a high school teacher and get his PhD while he taught high school. He remained a devoted teacher his entire life and continued to teach even on his deathbed. When 26-year-old Clausius read Thomson's papers, he was intrigued and felt like it might be a way to make his name and get out of teaching high school. Like Emily du Châtelet over 100 years before, Clausius took what seemed like desperate and opposing ideas and elegantly meshed them together.
So there's no elegant meshing. I mean, this is just such mush. Wave particle is not elegant meshing. MV squared and momentum and kinetic energy are not charmingly meshed together. They're directly opposed ideas. They create two physically completely different universes. Ugh.
In 1850, Clausius came up with a new theory that was, quote, opposed not to the real fundamental principles of Carnot, but to the addition, no heat is lost. Clausius wrote that Carnot's theories and the idea that heat is a form of energy that can be destroyed or created, quote, may not only exist together, but that they mutually support each other. And Clausius...
You can't make any sense of it. It can be destroyed, but it can't be destroyed. What is she saying? I don't understand. I don't understand that.
Included a new idea that he called interior work, but we now call internal energy.
Yeah, whatever. It doesn't mean anything. It's all the same thing. It's movement. It's all momentum. Little tiny pieces of nuclear stuff moving. Big giant collection of atoms moving. The big giant collection of atoms only moves if there's a bunch of little nuclear bits moving. The fish move the school of fish. The force moves everything, and the force is heat. It's weight. It's pressure. It's momentum. It's energy.
Which he gave the letter U. In fact, one of the modern forms of the first law, that the change in internal energy equals the heat added minus the work done by an object, is exactly how Clausius put it.
So you're just saying the work is just a way of saying the part we wanted, the heat we wanted, the heat we got to go into the laser beam. Any of the other heat that we couldn't funnel into the laser beam, okay, we're going to call something else. You know, that's the leftover bit. So work is just the part you take. And the waste is what's left over, you know, flying into the environment somewhere.
The same sign convention.
It's all heat.
And the same letters used. With this paper, Clausius made his mark on the scientific world and finally got a job as a professor. Meanwhile, Thomson said that he independently realized that Clausius was right and that heat is not conserved, but energy is.
So heat is not conserved, but energy is. It's just, and energy is kinetic energy, you know, supposedly. So again, momentum is conserved, heat is conserved. It's kinetic energy that, as Professor Lewin says, you can finagle.
In 1851 and 1855, Thomson published a series of papers on the nature and mathematics of heat and energy transfer. In these papers, Thomson used the term energy instead of living force, and in 1852, Thomson divided energy into two types, statical and dynamical.
Right, so this just becomes potential and kinetic, or whatever, right? Potential, active, well, whatever.
Which is very good etymology, in my humble opinion. However, another Scottish scientist named...
I think even better would be stored energy versus released energy, free energy versus stored energy. Better. but you still wouldn't get it because you still would call gravity potential energy. When it's not potential energy, it's sticking your finger in the stream. Gravity is sticking your finger in the stream. You don't have the potential. It doesn't have potential. It's an active stream.
William Rankine named it potential and actual in 1853, and Thomson renamed it potential and kinetic in 1855.
Yeah, so that's where it all came from, these words in the jargon, but obviously the concepts were the same back in Newton's day. They already understood what energy was as a concept, and because they didn't call it energy doesn't mean they didn't understand it as a concept, and they all knew, Descartes knew, and Newton knew, and Galileo knew that it's momentum, momentum, momentum. You don't need anything else. It works.
The names we are stuck with today. Although Clausius had innumerable petty arguments with Thomson, he agreed that the name energy was appropriate as, quote, an abbreviated mode of expression. And by 1865, Clausius had formed the first law to be, quote, the energy of the universe is constant.
So again, too silly if what you're saying is the mv squared is constant. You know, just what's the point?
As Richard Feynman said, quote, conservation of energy is a most abstract idea because it is not a description of a mechanism or anything concrete.
It doesn't make any sense not to understand it. So that's the funny part. Somehow it's not completely consistent with intuition to understand that you can watch the energy moving from thing to thing. I mean, again, it's go all the way back 350 years ago and they could kind of get the idea that, yeah, it seems like this, the movement thing just moves from one thing to another thing to another thing to another thing, and it never stops moving, and it just makes other things move as it's moving. As it transfers from one thing to another, it just infects it, causes it to move based on how much mass it has, and then it can be ejected and it goes somewhere else, and it, you know, not complicated. It infects a big object, it has a little effect. It infects a small object, it has a big effect, you know, from the object's perspective.
It's just a strange fact that we can calculate some number, and when we finish watching nature go through her tricks and calculate the number again, it is the same. But as
That should be one of the most intuitively sensible points somebody could make about the physical universe. You know, is that you just can't make it go away. You can't make the substance of it go away. It's like if there's a bird on the earth, there's a bird on the earth. It just doesn't poof out of existence.
The mathematical trick, it sure is powerful. In 1881, Thomson wrote, quote, the very name energy, first used in its present sense by Dr. Thomas Young, is now a principle pervading all nature and guiding the investigator in every field of science. Back to Clausius.
So, and again, then they're using the word exclusively to describe not momentum, but mv squared, 1/2 mv².
Clausius wasn't done yet, and in 1854, he came up with a new second law, which had to do with the heat divided by the temperature. Clausius stated that for a perfect reversible cycle, the heat divided by the temperature.
I mean, it just doesn't make much sense. Heat divided by temperature. What? Temperature divided by temperature? What are you talking about?
Temperature for the full cycle would add to zero.
Yeah, it sort of makes sense, I guess. If you're subtracting one from the other, but yeah, dividing, you know, 5 degrees into 5 degrees. I mean, again, I don't even know how to make sense out of that. No clue.
And for anything else, this quantity would be positive. In 1865, Clausius renamed this function entropy. But what is entropy? What does it mean? Why did he name it that?
Yeah, it doesn't mean much, frankly. Just this transfer from little things moving to big things moving, and that you could, essentially, it just depends on how you look at it. You know, if you make all the things little moving and they're not pushing anything, then nothing's moving because all the little things aren't pushing anything. Or you can make all the little things push something, and then your universe is clumpy and you have one big object moving in the universe, you know, or something like that. Not a perfect explanation, so we'll get to entropy some other time. Because it's it's a marginal a concept, and just really has to do with big things are always colder than little things. Just because they're further away from being converted into the little thing. It takes longer to convert it back into little things. They're further away, and the process to get them to being a little thing again requires more time. But anyway, I don't want to get into that one.
And what does it mean about our universe? Well, that is next time on The Lightning Tamers. Thanks for watching.
I don't know where she tames any lightning, but whatever. So it's pretty bad that she doesn't even pay, the concept of energy goes back to Galileo, Newton, and Descartes, and goes back further than that, obviously. So all that history is lost. Then she takes the nonsense of Leibniz, which wasn't a successful theory, and just shows the part where it was propagandized by people who could publish. So they published a bunch of propaganda that convinced people. But there wasn't any real hard experimental evidence demonstrating that five-ton trains going 10 miles an hour have more energy than 10-ton trains going 5 miles an hour. No evidence demonstrating that one has twice as much. So in spite of that fact, this was just pushed into the future as an idea without any experimental evidence demonstrating it to actually be true. And that's just a sad, tragic fact. And should be part of telling the history, is that they all drew these conclusions without any evidence. Yeah. So, all right. So enough of a video, I believe. So I will read some more of the De Châtelet stuff and see if there's anything really interesting. I mean, there are a few interesting things, so, but yeah, I'll save that for another video. And so till the next time and such and so forth and whatnot. This has been a draftphysics.com video presentation and such. Yeah, I really think that's enough.